Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's begun, and everything under the sun is in tune, and the sun is eclipsed by the moon. Yeah, hello there. Good evening. Welcome to the Astronomy Show right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. John Dixon here on my own tonight. Ben is on a mission. And the astronomy email is at astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. And the text or WhatsApps are 087-179-1032 if you'd like to do it that way. So you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie or astronomy.ie, or indeed even as a podcast. And a very special welcome to those of you joining us on astronomy.fm across the other side of the water. It's nice to hear that a lot of you are listening in there as well. So very good evening to you. Lots to get through tonight as usual. The International Space Station. Now, you may have seen it going through the sky at about 6:37 this evening. It lasted for about 5 minutes. So if you did see this bright light that looks like an aeroplane but doesn't flash like an aeroplane, that was the space station. It was quite high, but you're in for a treat as well, because again at 8:13 this evening, in about 3/4 of an hour's time or thereabouts, you will get to see it again. Unfortunately, this time is a little bit lower at 10 degrees above the west horizon, and it'll only be in our skies for 1 minute. Now, tomorrow evening, 5:49 p.m., if you want to put that in your diary, 7 minutes. This is a good long pass and one of the longest that you will get. And it will be 53 degrees up in the west, southwest. And again, at 7:25 p.m. So that's 5:49 p.m. and 7:25 p.m. And we're lucky enough, we're going to see it for the next couple of days, actually. Two times in quick succession, about an hour and a half apart. So again, that time for this evening, again 8:13 p.m. Only for 1 minute, but tomorrow again 5:49, and that's for 7 minutes. So that's a good way to watch it if the skies are clear, which will be great. Now, sunrise and sunset today, the 23rd of January. It rose this morning at 8:23 and set at 16:50. Now tomorrow, just give you an idea of what the time difference does. It's about 3 minutes and 10 seconds of a difference. And tomorrow it rises at 8:22 and sets at 16:52. So that's what the sun is doing at the moment. And moonrise and sunset and moonset tonight, 95.2 is the size of the moon, which is brilliant. And it's a waxing gibbous moon, if you want the fancy word for that. The next moonrise is at, it was 13:51 earlier on. We'll go into tomorrow, which will be the 24th, because it's easier for to do it that way. And it'll rise tomorrow at 14:58, just after lunchtime. And as it gets dark, you get to see that as well. And it'll set at 8:57 the following morning, the 25th. So you'll get to see that. So it's going to set, ooh, nicely. And the distance from us, from the moon at the moment, is 394,943 kilometres away. And it only stretches out in its little elliptical orbit to about 405. So we're very, very close to that. And the next new moon is, the full moon is on the 25th. Now, so you've been interested in buying a telescope. We got one for Christmas, so you got a pair of binoculars. And here's just a few pointers as to what these things do, these gadgets with multiple lenses and things like that. And telescopes make things bigger, but what exactly do they do? So the purpose is to collect light. This property lets you observe objects much fainter than you can see with your eyes alone. And the Italian astronomer Galilei, there's his full name, said it best when he declared that his telescopes revealed the invisible, and he's absolutely spot on about that. So when you buy a telescope, no matter what size it is, and the ideal thing to do is to probably save up a little bit and get the, I won't say the most expensive, because they are pretty expensive, and they will be complete. So They will have all the bits and pieces. They'll be ready for the sky as soon as you unpack them and put them together. A few models are optical tube assembly only. And that means that you're buying the optics in the tube with no tripod or accessories. So just be careful on that as well. Good ones to go for Smith Cassegrain SCT telescopes. Easy to maneuver. You can have anything from 4-inch to, I think, about 20, 21 inches just at the moment. So and you can go from any price range from, say, €500 up to as much as you want. So if you're interested in observing, what should you do first? So learn all about the telescopes, what types are available, the best accessories, and what you'll actually see through them. And if a telescope interests you, visit Celestron, which is the one that I have, and I have a thing that's quite old now at this stage. It doesn't have the go-to facility, because I know a lot of places in the sky at this stage. It was a good place for me to learn, but a lot have go-to facilities, which makes setting up a little bit easier, and probably will have a database of maybe 30,000 or up to 40,000 or even more, depending on the telescope that you buy. So the question is, do you buy binoculars before you buy a telescope? Now, that's totally up to you. There's a good book from Sir Patrick Moore, and it's Exploring the Night Sky with Binoculars. I would recommend that one. And in general, people would say no, get a telescope first, because if you're near a city, you won't be able to see an awful lot through binoculars, except if you're looking at the moon, for example. Don't look at the sun unless you have the solar filters, and you will get to see planets as well, but if you want to go a little bit deeper than that into star clusters and all that sort of things, or even the Milky Way, meteor trails, and even the moon, learn more about binoculars. That's the secret. And the other thing about the nighttime telescopes, which we would use, is that everything appears upside down. And that's because the way the telescope focuses light, the top of what you're looking at is actually at the bottom. As it enters the eyepiece and vice versa, you can reflip the image with an accessory called an image erector, but you'll lose a little bit of the object's light. So that's the reason that they try and just use the mirror and a lens for faint sky objects. And of course, you can use a telescope if you use that image erector for looking at terrestrial objects as well, so bird watching and all of that sort of stuff as well. So just a couple of pointers, but I would recommend the Celestron C8, that's a pretty good one, but there are some lovely telescopes out there. 4, the 5-inch and the 6-inch go-to telescopes from Celestron as well, ranging from, say, €500 up to just about €1,200 or €1,300, so that's good. So, that's really all I can say. Do a little bit of research on that, and you'll find your way through the sky quite easily. Now, this week's planet's roundup, Mercury. It remains around 11 degrees lower left of the bright Venus low in the dawn all this week, and remains at a -0.2, which is quite dim. And on my little app on the phone, you can just about see Mercury, but you've got to be very careful if looking into the sun that you have your solar screen that protects the light coming through and into your eyes, and it is not recommended to do that. Venus, on the other hand, magnitude -4.0. It shines as bright in the mornings as the morning star in the southeast during dawn, and it's getting lower every week, so it's going to disappear. So nearby is not only Mercury, but a sparkly orange Antares star as well, magnitude +1. And Antares is 17 degrees about Venus's right or upper right on January the 22nd, which was yesterday, so it's not going to be a million miles away now. Mars, lower left of Mercury, so they're sort of, the three of those are all sort of in the same vicinity, and in the bright dawn as well, with a mere magnitude of 1.4, so it's quite dim still, as it's a long, long way away from us. And at the moment it's, you know, unless you have a really good telescope, you're not going to really have a good chance to see it, even with binoculars. So Mars will actually creep very slowly into the dawn for the next 5 months. We're going to get a good little blast of Mars for the next few months, because we've been missing it for ages now at this stage. Jupiter, magnitude -2.5. And just to remind you, the minus figures are the brighter ones and the plus ones are the dimmer ones. And it's the bright white dot very high in the south in the early evening. And it sets around 1 a.m. in the morning or thereabouts, depending where you are. Saturn, on the other hand, magnitude plus 1, is in Aquarius just the moment. It sinks lower into the west-southwest during and after dusk. And it sets, again, wherever you are, whether you're looking at a tree-lined horizon or the horizon itself, it sets around 7 to 8 p.m. And it's Uranus time now. It's magnitude 5.6, very dim. Always a little devil of a thing to try and find. It's sitting in Aries as well. And when it gets dark, you will actually get a chance to see it, even through binoculars. And it's 13 degrees east, which is left of Jupiter in the early evening. And in a high telescope with high power, Uranus is a tiny but distinctly non-stellar ball, which means it doesn't flicker at us. And if you're into the arc seconds, and you know what they are, 3.8 arc seconds in diameter. Neptune, the last one, unfortunately, fainter than at magnitude 7.9, which is really dim. It's on the Pisces border. It's 21 degrees east of Saturn. And it's still moderately high in the southwest after dark. Neptune is, unfortunately, only 2.3 arc seconds wide, so it's quite a small area of the sky to try and very hard to resolve as a ball if you're looking through a telescope or a good pair of binoculars. So that's what to see just in the sky at the moment. Again, they don't change an awful lot during the week. Next week it won't be an awful lot different, but again, we would get to see Mars slowly creeping a little bit further into our skies as well. And you're listening to The Astronomy Show, 103.2 Dublin City FM. John Dixon here till till 8 o'clock tonight, actually. And unfortunately, my text machine has just sat down on me there and just disappeared off my screen. So if I get a chance to pull that back onto the system, I shall do that just before I go at 8 p.m. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we had the Peregrine moon lander, which was the private moon lander, and it took off and unfortunately sprung a leak and let a lot of the propellant out into the atmosphere of space, if you want to call it that. And unfortunately, they were trying to decide exactly what to do with this, whether to let it out into space or bring it back to Earth. But during the week, on January the 18th, they let it crash into Earth's atmosphere in the South Pacific. And it, for any of you those who have seen it, I haven't seen any pictures or anything that have given us any inclination as to how bright it might have been coming back into or even into the sky as it burnt up into the Pacific Ocean. So they reckon that probably all of it burnt up, and the cause of the fuel leak was something that was a breakage somewhere in this. So the launch itself was very, very good, and instead of going to the moon now, Peregrine has journeyed back to Earth and fell apart in the planet's atmosphere back here on Earth on Thursday last, on January the 18th. And the spacecraft builder, Pittsburgh company, Astrobotic, pledged as a safe re-entry path as possible. So there would be no shipping or anything in the area as well. So that was a little bit unfortunate for that, because quite an expensive little piece of kit that was to make a safe landing on the moon into the near distant future. Now, we had a European crew arriving at the ISS on a private mission this time. It's an all-European crew, including Turkey's first astronaut, and he arrived at the International Space Station on Saturday on a voyage chartered by Axiom Space, and it was dubbed as Axiom Space Mission 3, AX3, and it's the company's third launch into the space laboratory, and the first were all three of the paid seats were bought by national agencies. So I reckon about $200,000 per seat might have done that, maybe a little bit more if you want a window seat. Yep, and although you can probably see in there, seemingly they're quite a big spacecraft as well. So the spacecraft itself docked at the ISS at 10:43 GMT on January the 20th, which was a few days back. And they boarded within 2 hours after everything was made safe, and they opened up the cockpits and climbed their way through. So the SpaceX Crew Dragon fixed atop of the Falcon 9 rocket blasted off from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in the U.S. state of Florida. So, and the ISS itself, the space station, is only, would you believe, if you turned Ireland on its side and added a tiny little bit, 260 miles up above our heads. And it took 36 hours to get and catch up with these. And strangely enough, if they are unmanned, they tend to go an awful lot quicker. They just catch up as fast as they can. But when there are people on board, it's a completely different kettle of fish altogether. So there we go. So again, the Peregrine, this was called the Peregrine Moonlander, it's crashed back into the sea there a couple of days back as well. So astronomers have detected, would you believe, the oldest black hole ever observed. And researchers have discovered the oldest black hole dating from the dawn of the universe and found that it is eating its host galaxy and still after all these years. So they reckon this, which dates from maybe 400 million years from the Big Bang, more than 13 billion years ago to us. And the results, which lead author Professor Roberto Maiolino, says are a giant leap forward. So this is a surprisingly massive black hole, size-wise, a few million times the mass of our sun, and it even exists so early in the universe, and it challenges our assumptions of how black holes form and grow. So it's the James Webb Telescope doing its stuff to find further and further into space as it possibly can. It's a remarkable thing to be able to see back in time, considering we've already been through the time, but it's all to do with wavelengths and all that sort of stuff. So the big long wavelengths in the infrared and lower than that are the ones we would see that in, which allows us to appear back into time and space, whereas the quicker, brighter ultraviolet spectrum would let us see the quicker aspects of space as well. So it's all to do with light wavelengths. Now, NASA has re-established contact with its tiny helicopter on Mars. The space agency said just on Saturday after an unexpected outage prompted fears that the hard-working craft had finally met its end. This is a drone. It's a five-bladed drone. Its name is Ingenuity, if most people would understand that. And it's about half a meter across, half a meter tall. It arrived in Mars in 2021, and that's hard to believe as well, just time marches on so quickly, and aboard the rover Perseverance, and became the first motorized craft to fly autonomously on another planet. So, good news today. They reckon that they have made contact with it again, because it was a small outage. Maybe it was to do with some of the light not hitting the solar panels, we just don't know at the moment. And they're trying to assess why they lost that, but they're such a delight when they all got the messages back in their office in the back in the US. So the mini rotorcraft or drone, which weighs only 4 pounds or 1.8 kilos, has far exceeded its original goal, would you believe this, of just over 30 days. Now I think they do this on purpose. Spirit and Opportunity, going back to 2004, which is not yesterday or the day before, were doing 90 days of experiments. Unfortunately, Spirit slid down a sand dune and unfortunately is no more because its sight with the sun for its panels didn't make it. And it ended up losing power, but Opportunity is still going. And this is 2024, so 2004 to 2024 still beaming in information. And the mini rotorcraft, actually the drone, has covered about 10 miles, which is 17 kilometers, and it's reached altitudes of 24 meters. And that's not too bad now for a planet that doesn't have much atmosphere. And they're saying that its longevity has proved remarkable, particularly considering that it must survive glacially cold Martian nights. And of course, kept warm by the solar panels that recharge its batteries during the daylight hours. So the technology involved in this and the money that's spent is absolutely mind-boggling. And they have oodles of plans to go to the moon and Mars in the future. So let's hope and fingers crossed that we'll get to see a little bit more action, maybe landing on the moon and even landing on Mars. Maybe not in our lifetimes here, or certainly mine anyway, but we'll see what happens. Now, space travel is the big worry about taxing astronauts' brains. But if they were to have microbes on the menu, they could help in the unexpected ways. So, feeding astronauts on long missions, and this is a big, big thing just at the moment, that they're trying to invent menus that will be of benefit to any of the astronauts going to the longer planets, Mars, or even to the moon, and ensuring, of course, that they have enough nutrients and calories to survive their multi-year journey. And it certainly will be a multi-year journey. Providing astronauts with the right diet is also paramount in supporting their mental and cognitive health in a way unlike previous missions. As they're sort of really on their own for quite a long time. So they've had to radically rethink on how to feed astronauts. It's not only been challenging on the mission to Mars, which could be on the cards as late as the 2030s or early 2040s. It's not really that far away, but to prepare for possible settlements on the red planet, this is what they need to plan ahead for. And they reckon that lettuce is not one of the things, although they think it's quite good for you, it's not going to be good for you on a long flight into space. So, microbes, we go back to them. A healthy balance of microbes is important under such challenging conditions, and how we could put microbes on the menu. I suppose it's like the yogurty type things with millions of bacteria and things growing and helping us to function. And why are the missions to Mars so challenging is the big question. Deep space missions will expose humans to immense physical and psychological challenges, and these include prolonged isolation from loved ones. This is one of the big things. Extreme space and resource constraints, and the difficulties, of course, of microgravity on bone and structure and things like that. So they have to exercise as well. So I suppose they're saying that the disruption to the astronauts' circadian rhythms, prolonged radiation exposure, this is the other one as well, and dietary changes can also lower their cognitive performance and well-being. So you have to be a strong person, and the choosing of the astronauts process is a big, big, long process, and they can probably have maybe 3,000 down to, whittle them down to 5, and then whittle them down to 2 or 3, and then make their mind up who is actually going to go to further planets like the Moon and to Mars. Again, you're listening to The Astronomy Show right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Apologies about my text line. It's just disappeared off my screen. Oh, it's in there somewhere. I promise I will try and get that back as soon as I can, but unfortunately I need to twiddle a few buttons and things like that as well. So that's what we need to look into, and to do it just shortly after the program is finished. Okay. Right, now, how NASA's twin rovers changed Mars scientists. I did mention in January 2004, twin NASA rovers named Spirit and Opportunity touched down on the opposite side of Mars, so they didn't actually see each other. And this kicked off a new era of interplanetary robotic exploration. Now, I've been following these since we started this program way back in 2004. And they arrived in dramatic fashion, about 3 weeks apart, which is remarkable. They each nestled in a cluster of airbags that bounced along the surface around 30 times before coming to a stop and then deflating. And then the golf cart-sized rovers, which are nice-sized rovers, started to look for evidence that water once flowed on the red planet's surface. And their findings would rewrite science textbooks, including Opportunities to Discover soon after landing of the famous blueberries. These are the spherical pebbles of the mineral hermatite that had formed in acidic water. So there is evidence, and they have proven this from all the photographs that have come back. And even several years into the mission, Spirit, undaunted about dragging a damaged wheel and had to reverse everywhere, unfortunately. And it uncovered signs of an ancient hot spring that could have been ideal habitats for microbial life billions of years ago. So the science continues, whether it's Curiosity, the twin rovers, Perseverance, the drone, anything else. It's just absolutely remarkable. So there we go. And just talking about potential water that was on Mars, or may have been on Mars, we're not quite sure. Mars Express unveils potential water resources for future Mars missions at the equator. And I don't have an awful lot of information just at the moment because it's brand spanking new, but they've made a significant breakthrough in our understanding of Mars's hydrological history by uncovering extensive layers of water ice at the planet's equator, which is, sorry, I was reading ahead there. So absolutely interesting to see the photographs, and well worth a Google if you can get to see any of the pictures of the surface of the planet Mars. And just slipping back a little bit further, well, a little bit nearer, I suppose, to the moon. Moon rocks with unique dust has been found. And as a lot of us would know, it's completely covered in dust. Unlike here on Earth, the dust is not smoothed by wind or weather, but it's got a sharp-edged and electrostatically charged dust. And this is the stuff that's stuck to the astronauts' legs and dusts their suits. And they've been studied since the Apollo era at the end of the 1960s. And, of course, they were caked in dust when they came back. And now an international research team led by Dr. Ottaviano Rusch from the University of Munster has for the first time discovered anomalous meter-sized rocks on the lunar surface that are covered in dust. And these ones presumably exhibit unique properties such as magnetic anomalies. So evidently the rocks at some stage are able to attract dust as well. Now, we had a Japanese moon lander called the Sniper mission. And it made a historic, or an historic, I'm not sure which way to say that, touchdown on the lunar surface over the weekend using pinpoint technology. This is what they're saying. They got it to land within 100 meters of where its intended landing spot was. Unlike, I suppose, of the Apollo missions where they sort of landed where they could. Hopefully not into the middle of a crater, but as Neil Armstrong guided his craft, Apollo 11, onto the surface, onto a flat place as well. So it's the nickname of the Moon Sniper. It arrived onto the moon's surface, 1500 GMT, that's 3 o'clock our time, just on Friday. And the touchdown was very, very good. Now, they say they've lost a little bit of power, and it's they're trying to get into that, but they reckon they can get that back again as well. Anyway, time marches on, unfortunately, and that's the end of another program here of the Astronomy Show. Thanks very much indeed for listening. That email address, once again, for comments and questions is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. Back again next week with Ben this time, and thanks again to James Sweeney and Conor Lennon for making the show available on astronomy.ie and indeed as a podcast. So that's all from me, John Dixon, from this particular edition of The Astronomy Show. Thank you for tuning in our way. And now it's music all the way until 2 a.m. right here in 103.2 Dublin City FM. Things to look forward to. Next, Threads. Yeah, and this is worth listening to. Super duper music that we wouldn't normally hear on the normal radio stations. 10 p.m. till midnight, we've Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood. And he has his take on world music, and Midnight After Hours with Dave Barry with his jazz, blues and soul until 2 a.m. So that's your lineup for the rest of the evening. And please join myself and Ben the same time next week at 7:30 p.m. and we'll be back with the latest news from around the universe. Till then, take care of each other. Thanks for listening and say good night, John. Good night, John. See you next week. Bye bye.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.